Welcome to the Debate at G8 podcast series, exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Cantelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics, touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. Today, we'll be exploring the life and work of one of Australia's most eminent scientists, Professor Brian Schmidt, who's also the Deputy Chair of the Group of Eight and Vice Chancellor of the ANU. Professor Schmidt won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2011 and has spent most of his academic career as an astrophysicist. Joining us for this podcast is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities, who, like me, is keen to find out more about our expanding universe. Well, firstly, Professor Brian Schmidt, it was under your leadership in 1998 that the HiZ supernova search team made the startling discovery that the expansion rate of the universe is accelerating. Can you tell us about some of that game-changing work?
Yeah, well, I came to Australia at the very end of 1994, and my pitch was to measure how fast the universe is expanding back in time. So if you look at really, really distant objects, you're looking back in time. And so with the new technology, which involved digital cameras, which we all know about now, new computers and software, we were able to go back with the telescopes of the day and these digital cameras, look back in time, measure how fast the universe is expanding back in time. And then we got a very funny answer, which was that the universe was not slowing down to gravity like we expected. Rather, it was speeding up, and that was sort of the wrong answer, but it means that 70% of the universe is stuff we didn't know existed, stuff we call dark energy now, that spread absolutely smoothly across the universe, causes gravity to push rather than pull.
Because initially it was thought that gravitational forces would slow the speed of the expansion of the universe, but you proved the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, we know gravity pulls on everything, right? That's how gravity works. Well, it turns out in Einstein's theory of general relativity, that's normally true unless you have energy that is part of space itself. And under his equations, and he realized this back in 1917, gravity could actually push on the universe, but it has to be of this very specific form, which he called the cosmological constant, we call dark energy now, but there was no reason to believe it was actually there. So our discovery was actually seeing 70% of the universe is this stuff, and we still don't know why it's there.
So what are the overall consequences of these sorts of findings?
So, I mean, for the long term, it means we live in a universe that is getting bigger and bigger, faster and faster. Things we see on the other end of the universe are literally disappearing before our very eyes, very, very slowly, it turns out. But we will never see more of the universe than we see right now. And the universe will last forever and will kind of fizzle out over time. So the universe ends not with a bang, but with a whimper.
So T.S. Eliot was right.
Yeah, indeed.
So what does it actually mean in an everyday context? People listening and watching, and there's been this amazing discovery. What impact does that have on them and their everyday lives?
Well, it's at some level, it's very cerebral, right? We are trying to understand our place in the universe. So if you ever see a four-year-old look up the star, they want to know what's going on. They don't care about whether or not it makes them a better peanut butter sandwich. They care about how does the world work. And so we're really working on that. But on the journey there, we did lots of things. So I talked about these digital cameras. Well, guess what? They're used everywhere. Those are an invention right out of astronomy. If you look at the World Wide Web, well, that's an invention out of CERN trying to understand how the dark energy is created and dark matter and things like that. If you look at the Wi-Fi, well, that's out of Australian astronomy trying to look for evaporating black holes. So along the way to understand these cerebral things that I think the average person kind of wants to know about. Mm. You have to invent and revolutionize the world around you. And that's how science works. It's not directed always at building the widget that everyone cares about, but it's how you invent the new widgets that no one thought of before.
So it is about the journey as much as the destination. And that is true, particularly, I guess, for our universities, the Group of Eight, because we do so much basic research, which is about a journey of discovery.
Yeah, and that journey of discovery is important. And, you know, I have people come up to me and say, well, can't we just avoid that? Can't we just invent it? Mm. And the answer is, well, you could try, but it doesn't seem to work. You need to get the creative juices flowing. And it turns out trying to understand what the universe is doing back in time is a really interesting force to get people to think about everything and take nothing for granted, and in the process invent lots of interesting technologies. And yeah, we need to then make the widgets and commercialize it, and that's something we celebrate and we do. But you kind of have to do the whole journey to get to where we are now, which is, you know, the most prosperous that humanity has ever been, even if on any given day it doesn't seem that good sometimes.
So let's bring it back to Earth a little and get an understanding of where your passion for science began. You would often assist your father as he progressed his PhD work in biology. Tell us about your bug-catching days with your father in the US.
Yeah, so my parents had me when they were very young, and my father went off to do a PhD at Oregon State University in Corvallis. And I remember as probably not part of the PhD, but something he was doing, and I can't quite remember why, but I was literally asked to hold a butterfly net out the window into the ditch, and we drove down. I think this was actually to entertain me, quite frankly, but it's something he had learned during his degree. So we were driving down the ditch and literally filled this thing up, and, you know, you're like, what's going to be in there? And the answer is, oh, my God, there are bugs out there you had no idea existed. And it was just full of bazillions of bugs of all sorts and descriptions you'd never seen before. Very simple technique, as long as you don't hit a rock or something. But it really opened my eyes, as you can imagine, that there's a lot of things hidden out there you don't know about. And that's one of the great things about science is that the whole universe, there's all these hidden marvels that you just miss if you don't look. And there's opportunity in that knowledge.
Did you always have this as a natural curiosity, or was it something instilled by your father, do you think?
You know, probably a little bit of both. I tend to believe that most people are able to be most things, and that we tend to get the environment we're brought in tends to make you go the direction you did. And so I certainly found this intriguing as a 3 or 4 year old, but I think most kids in the world probably would have as well. So I had, you know, the fortune of having a scientist father. And for me, it really lit the curiosity I had of science. And I think that it isn't necessarily, though, that I was just innately born with this. I think it's something you gain due to your exposure. And that's why it's really important to have all these programs for everyone in Australia, for example, to get a taste of science when they're really young, in case, you know, their parents aren't scientists.
That's a really important – sorry, Ron.
There you go.
I should say that's a really important point, because we know in the area of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, that we often lose kids before they even get to university. Mm. And you know, all of the kind of evidence now from the relevant bodies is that we've got to get to kids – you know, it used to be kind of 13, 14, now it's sort of 7 and 8, and really ignite that passion and that interest, because we lose them. And of course, losing them has a significant impact on our future as an economy, as a country, et cetera. So I'm just stealing one of your questions here, Ron, but I'm just wondering, how do you not just instill that level of curiosity in kids at school, but maintain it so that we can get them into our universities and we can get them into the workforce and into those areas that you know, we know there are massive national shortages of now?
Well, this week I talked to CANASTA, which is the Association of Science Teachers across Australia. They had their first meeting in a few years in person here in Canberra, so I went and had a chat with them. And it's exactly what we discussed. I actually think through things like the primary connection, something that I helped fund with my Nobel Prize winnings, where it gives primary teachers the tools they need to make science relevant and interesting. And I actually think up to sixth grade, we're still doing pretty well if you look at it. The problem is 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, where suddenly we have this mindset, and I think it's a mindset where there are people who do science and people who don't, and it's incredibly gendered. And we need to get out of that. We need to really focus on those places, and that 13, 14, really critical, where we don't make this false dichotomy that there are people who are good at science and there are people who are not. Everyone needs to know bits of science, just like everyone needs to be literate. You really don't get to opt in or out of either for the future. You need to do both. So I think it's really focusing on the places we lose people. And I think it's in that sort of 10, 11 to about 15 where we make the false claim that, you know, some people are good at science
stream
and some
people into different areas.
I just think everyone needs to have a bit of that going forward.
Well, you mentioned we lose people, but I'm sure Australia is very, very happy that it found you and got you. How did that come about? How did you come to be in Australia?
Yeah, well, it's more complicated than it would look at first brush. My uncle, my mother's brother, emigrated to Australia in 1973. And he moved first to Perth and then went up through WA, ended up in Darwin. I came over with my grandmother and spent 3 months in Australia as a 13-year-old. And then I came back, spent 3 months as an 18-year-old, also visiting my uncle, had moved down to Geelong. And so I'm a Geelong Cats supporter and was at the grand final.
That's where we must part ways, Professor Schmidt.
So big week.
Was there on the weekend and my first grand final. So I had spent 6 months of my life in Australia, and indeed I played, I was a French horn player, and the Anchorage Youth Symphony played here at ANU in 1985 at Llewellyn Hall. Yeah. So that was my first connection to Canberra. So go forward a few more years. I'm at Harvard. I meet an Australian who's an economist doing her PhD at Harvard, and we have to find a place to both have careers. So we applied everywhere. We applied all over the United States, applied over Europe, applied to Australia. And in the end, as I said at the Jobs and Skills Summit, you know, it was really hard for the two of us to get a job. And in any other place in Australia, you know, had a visa system that made it very easy. I applied 4 times to get a job here, but eventually got one. We applied all over the United States. In the end, we came to Canberra, because my wife and I both got excellent jobs. But it was a competition. It wasn't like, oh, you just came here because of your wife. No, it was two careers, and we ended up here because I had a deep connection to the country. I understood what it was. But ultimately, it was the best place for me to come.
So you come to this country and you win the Nobel Prize, you mentioned before, for this work with the supernova. What impact did that have on your life?
Oh, well, I always describe winning a Nobel Prize as it's like saying, I like chocolate, and then a dump truck of chocolate comes and dumps and kind of destroys your life chocolate.
Is it too much?
I won't say it's too much, but it is overwhelming.
Do you mean it's a heavy burden to carry?
Well, it's a little bit of everything, right? It's suddenly, you know, I got called up at 8:39 p.m., when we had just had sports, so we were still doing dinner and we're making a green curry. And I remember when I realized what was happening, I looked at my wife and I said, I am so sorry. and she's like, what? And I'm like, I have just won the Nobel Prize. It is going to completely screw our lives up. And it's just, you know, next morning I'm in meeting the prime minister and around the world, you know, bazillions of times since.
You were quite young too, weren't you?
Yeah, I was 44. Yeah.
Right.
So you get all these opportunities to do so many things. And I do. I am someone who feels a genuine obligation to use what is ultimately, you know, sort of a random event that happens where they make you this very famous person overnight. And I wanted to do good with that. So I do feel an obligation to do it. But it's just so much of anything. You get to meet, you know, President Obama, met him twice in the first 3 months, met Bono, you know, you name it. It happened very quickly.
And could you use it to pursue other things? Were there, you know, moments that, say, even at the with the group of eight, are there ways in which you can use that cachet?
Yeah, you got to be very careful about it because you will see people who try to use their cachet too much and they end up not smelling very good after a little while. So, you know, immediately one of the first things I did is this program I already described, Primary Connections, which was, I think, the single most useful way to teach science at K through 6 was being, you know, shut down by the government of the time. And I went through and said, I am gifting you $50,000 to get you through the next few months. But that became known. And I would say it ended up essentially blackmailing the government of the day to invest $4 million to keep it alive. But everywhere I go, like at Canasta, everyone said, thank you for doing that. It's still really, really important. So you can use your cachet that way. Another place in 2015, I could see the COP in Paris coming, and I was really worried about whether we're going to be able to make it go. I, you know, helped draft and organize the Mino Declaration that was presented by two of my colleagues to the COP delegation in Paris. And it was a little thing where you can say, this group of people really think this is important. So I try to go easy on not using it and abusing it, but I am prepared in the group of eight to speak out very firmly when, for example, a minister decides to disallow grants in a way that is completely inconsistent with worldwide practice. And, you know, I was on to that within 15 minutes before I had even thought about it. And because it was just so clear to me something needed to happen. And you do get cut through in that way. And, you know, I think we've eventually got a reasonable outcome. And I hope that I can continue to have a voice where I need to be, but I don't want to overplay my hand.
Do you ever find it overwhelming?
I don't find it as overwhelming now. I certainly found it overwhelming for the first couple of years. But I find being a vice chancellor overwhelming.
Well, I want to talk to you about that.
Being a vice chancellor is an amazingly hard job. And everyone should feel sorry for their vice chancellors and worry less about how much they're paid.
I've got a feeling they're not going to feel sorry for you.
These are really hard jobs. And I say it as someone who, you know, came into the role completely outside. They're really challenging jobs.
Why?
Because you've got a university, so ANU, roughly 4,000 staff, 2,000 academics, and I would describe them as 2,000 soul traders, right? Who you have to organize into a coherent group to go and, you know, do research at the cutting edge, go out and translate that research into companies and, you know, products and services for the nation to teach Australia's future leaders, you know, 40% of them who are going to be leaders across any discipline of management, and in a really critical part of their time, that time between 17 and 22, you know, it's a big, complicated, it's not a business, but it's like a billion-dollar business, except for you don't have any of the levers that a CEO has to actually get it to act sensibly. You have to do everything by consensus and this really soft leadership. And that's why it's a hard job. And you have to make really hard decisions, especially over the last 2.5 years. Yeah.
I remember, Brian, you and I started our roles. I was starting the Group of Eight and you starting at ANU in 2015. And we were on a train in Japan, because I think we were over there with the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. So you hadn't yet started, but I think you were just about ready to start. And I remember saying to you, you know, what do you think? Are you ready for it? And I'm just wondering, from 2015, which isn't that long ago, but it feels so long ago because so much has happened both domestically and internationally, how much has changed, do you think, in that, 7 years that you've been running the Australian National University? And the second part of that question is, how much of your background has worked really positively for you in sort of corralling those researchers and the administrators, and has it worked against you in some ways?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think we're in the middle of whatever change is happening, and it's really difficult for me to quite see the end of the tunnel. I also think the change that's happening between 2015 and 2022 is going to be highly varied across the sector. So the university sector across Australia, in one sense, is very heterogeneous. There's all sorts of universities, but the reality is it's a very homogeneous funding way of funding compared to the rest of the world. So I think we're going to see some changes, but it's kind of difficult to tell who's going to do the changings or what. I actually think the role of the ANU, I came in with a few things that I really wanted to do, which was make sure that we are the national university. I think ANU had started moving away from its role as national university, and I said, I don't want to be just another university. I want to be the national university. So we have, as an institution, pivoted there, I think, pretty well. I wanted to really think about how students interact with universities, and that's the place where I think we're going to see a lot of change happening, where we sort of had every university was kind of the same. People commuted into campus, commuted out. And we're beginning to see that model break up quite a lot across the sector. So I think that's the thing that's going to change a lot.
Are you talking about the online side of things here?
It's going to be, online, different types of delivery for people at different career stages. I just think you're going to see universities start filling out that ecosystem quite a bit differently than pre-COVID. I think the Group of Eight, because we're research intensives, are going to continue to have that strong campus-based experience. But I would expect a number of other institutions to probably look to fulfill their missions slightly differently. But we haven't quite seen how that shakes out. It's coming. It's always hard to tell the change in the middle of it. You'll know it at the end and say, that's what was going on.
Do you think that we have the political courage and will to actually, and we've had this debate a lot about Australian universities. Mm. There's one argument that we're all the same, but actually we are quite different. But Brian's right, we're funded the same. And it always, everything comes down to politics, always comes down to politics, as you know. Do we have the political will and leadership and courage, both at the political level, but also at our own level, to actually see through the changes that need to be made? And that may mean some uncomfortable conversations about different missions for different universities.
So I'm not sure. Based on the last 20 years, I would say no. And I don't mean that against any individual. I would just say it's very difficult to change when life is okay. COVID has provided a shock, and I think that will probably cause some of this change. But in terms of radical change, I don't think it'll happen until there is no way out. And that will be some sort of huge financial shock that, brings 20% of the sector to its knees. And then I think you could radically reform. Mm-hmm. Whether or not we're prepared to do that, not clear. So it's interesting. I do a lot of work in Singapore. And Singapore's prepared to kind of really go through and change things over time. I'd love to see us be willing to adopt some things, but the status quo, especially something like a university where everyone cares about it a bit, but no one cares about it in the political sphere a lot, right? They take us for granted.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that we have to at least start to have the conversations. And even having those conversations are very challenging, mm-hmm. because what happens is we retreat, and I use the royal we, to our corners.
Yep.
And I don't think that's actually productive for the sector. And so I've certainly said for a long time, and I know Brian said something similar, that we need to at least have those discussions without vested interest where we can.
And I do think, if the compact conversations come up, can be not just a set of words, but actually have financial considerations around it to fund people's unique missions.
Compacts are our funding agreements, mm-hmm. between government and
universities. Yeah, well, and there's meant to be a renewed view of how they work. And so right now I would describe as a compact as a paper tiger. Mm. It's something you say, I'm going to do this, and every year you look at it, but nothing actually necessarily changes, or it may or may not change, but there's no accountability really through that. So if there was a funding accountability mechanism through the compact agreement that were to say, let's just take regional universities and say regional universities have a different mission than ANU. It's an important mission, and the current way we fund those isn't quite right. We need to have a specific set of funding, and doing it, these universities are going to do these great things for regional Australia. That would be a good step forward. And I think that's the way to maybe get it through the politics.
Yeah.
But you can't do it for zero sum. There actually has to be new money. And I'm telling you, the sector, if you're actually going to do research and high quality education, needs new money.
Mm. Yeah.
Can't be done for free.
Yeah.
I'm just aware of the time, and I wanted to move. We started talking about these orbs in the sky that you studied, and I want to bring it down to these little orbs on the ground, grapes, that you have a particular passion for. And I noticed you've got a Twitter handle. It's Cosmic Pino.
That's correct. Cosmic Pino.
So as a Nobel Prize winner, is this the ultimate escape from the bigger questions involving the universities and outer space and all that, to zero in on the beauties of a Pinot?
Indeed. I planted that in 2000, and it's sort of my therapy. It was the therapy to keep astronomy from completely taking over my life, because I planted it well before the Nobel Prize. But I do use it as my therapy to keep the issues of the university and everything else from taking over my life. And it's a place where I have really good thoughts. You know, I used to think in the shower. Now I think while out trimming vines. So,
you're also a cook, aren't you?
I love to cook,
yes. Often puts up posts of his, you know, raspberry puddings or raspberry cakes. We follow them all.
I love to cook. I love to eat, unfortunately. That's the other part of it. But it's something quite different. There is a little bit of chemistry and things to it, but it's really almost like an artistic expression, going out and making wine. And it has a cycle of the seasons and real rhythm to it, which I love.
And is there something particular about the Pinot grape? Because it's described as one of the more delicate grapes one of the hardest wines to get right.
I like doing really hard things. So I played the French horn. That's the instrument that you were allowed to make a mistake on, even in a great orchestra. And Pinot is the wine you're allowed to make a mistake on, even as a great winemaker. So I like doing things where they're really hard and expectations are low. Running the ANU, for example.
Well, look, it's been fantastic talking to you. And we could go on forever. But cheers to a Pinot.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to The Debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.